This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM's Budget 2019 programming, presented to you by Masing.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Eun Teik. I have on the line with me today Dr. Jayakumar Devaraj of Parti Socialist Malaysia, here with me to discuss his thoughts on Budget 2019. First, I think I would like to start with, what did you like and dislike about Budget 2019?
Okay. Well, I think one thing we must commend the government is that it is not an austerity budget. There's been an increase in the overall allocation of about 8% over the past year's budget because of all the pressures they're facing, you know, in terms of the unpaid GST rebates, the tax rebates, the outstanding 1MDB loans. One would have thought they may have tried to go into a more of an austerity budget, you see. But I think it's good that they didn't do that. So the budget actually has gone up a bit, and despite the fact that that means our deficit is now, what, 3.4%?
Right.
And they really want to go for 2%, is it? But they're prepared to postpone that for a later date, but to maintain the public expenditure. So I think that, I think the government should be commended for that.
And what did you dislike about?
Dislike is some of the things that they've talked about to strengthen fiscal administration. They're talking about selling, basically privatizing, but use different words like monetizing and, you know, mobilizing assets and all that. They're talking of selling off government assets to pare down budget. So the question is, to whom and at what terms are they going to sell these assets? The way in which the PSM looks at it is that, you know, when you have control of the economy, the government controls the economy through the GLCs, then the government can ask the GLCs to implement socially beneficial policies, you know, like, for example, childcare in the place of work. In terms of a higher minimum wage in those GLC companies, in terms of worker participation in management, in terms of fostering unions. So a government can actually use the GLCs to set a benchmark that they would like the other part of the economy to follow as well. You know, so when you let go of that, you know, your hold over the economy and your hold and your capacity to play the leadership role, you know, in setting certain good terms, is compromised, you see?
Mm-hmm.
So, and then the other thing they're talking about is talking of public-private partnerships for public projects. These usually end up more expensive than if the government does it itself, you know? And we are scared that they'll get too close to developers and the private business interests and have these PPP projects, when it actually can be done more cheaply if a government agency takes and does it. Let's say, for example, building hospitals. You can have a dedicated government company, maybe a part of the JKR, to get the expertise, to get the proper engineers, and then build hospitals at cost. It'll be cheaper, you know. And instead of each hospital you tender, and different people get it because they quote better things, but without the experience, and you end up with fungus in the ventilation, you know, shafts, you get leaking roofs, you get OTs, the aircons don't work. You know, so many hospitals you see costing about $500 million. And then you find they are delayed, you know, there are a lot of technical problems because it's a specialized area. So why can't the government develop the expertise? I mean, after all, you're going to need hospitals. So why can't we itself have a company that you know, a government-owned company, which or an agency that does that. So instead of the PPP, I think not a good idea. PPPs usually end up not giving us value for money.
So it may be cheaper, but as you mentioned, there are the pressure from the obligations to service debt, and also there's pressure to not put out an austerity budget. And so without going through this PPP model or the privatization model, how would they be able to raise funds, assuming that they can't introduce too many new taxes as well, because that would introduce another burden negating the impact of eliminating the GST in the first place?
There are constraints the government is under. You know, any government, even a left government, would face the same problem. But coming back to this PPP thing, I mean, you could, for example, if you need to sell some government land to raise some money, that's a separate issue from going into a PPP immediately, because you can use that money for your own agency. So two different things. How you raise money and how you spend the money are two different. The PPP is how you spend it. And very often the PPPs, they borrow money from the capital markets, they raise bonds with government guarantees. So it's not that you are completely getting all the funding from them, you know. They're giving the expertise, but a lot of the funds is raised with government guarantees. So why can't you raise your own, you know, float your own bonds and raise money yourself? So, I mean, it's something that needs to be studied, you know. The other thing about, you mentioned about the difficulty in raising
revenues,
money.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is always going to be a problem because we are in competition with Singapore and in competition with Thailand, who are cutting down corporate tax in effort to get more investment. So I think that is something that the PSM has been talking about, that there's a need among the ASEAN countries to say, let us not compete with each other in this way and go to the bottom. If we all agree to keep our corporate taxes where it is, or even go up 1% every year for the next 5 years from wherever we are, then our comparative advantage or disadvantage remains the same. Especially now with the trade war between US and China, you know, the ASEAN region may be a good place for companies to come and locate because they can circumvent the trade war. They can, you know, they can export things to us, to both sides, you see. So we're in a slightly better position, and we should capitalize on that by using the ASEAN framework to say, let us all increase our corporate tax by 1% from wherever we are for the next 5 years. And if anyone doesn't do that, we put a tariff on the goods from that country to the other ASEAN countries. So use our ASEAN free trade agreement as a way of enforcing this. And this will help all our countries need money, you see. All our countries need government revenue, which then they can use for infrastructure development, you know, for welfare programs, for whatever they want to. I mean, there's so much need for money for things like that. So this is something that needs to be done over time, you see. We can't take the existing economic order as given by God. It's man-made. And so man can adjust it. So I'll agree, we can't raise our corporate tax by 5% straight away. And, you know, that thing may damage our economy. But why don't we talk with the other ASEAN countries to do it in stages? You know, it's good for them. And the increased government expenditure would actually increase aggregate demand in the whole of the ASEAN region and increase the market for all our businesses. It's like it's a virtual cycle.
Having a collective action ASEAN-wide for increased corporate tax, that would be against the neoliberal system that we currently live in, isn't it? And the other measure that PSM and yourself has been vocal about is the issue of minimum wage and how it's also a race to the bottom among countries. But in this budget, the finance minister said that the target is to increase it to 1,100 and a further increase of 50 ringgit. Mm. What are your comments on that? How high do you want it to be? And is this a sign that the government is acknowledging that there is a need to raise the floor of the minimum wage?
Actually, you know, PSM has asked for 1,005, but, you know, if it had gone up to even 1,002, we'd be happy with it. Because after all, the National Wage Council, which looked at the whole picture, we listened to both sides, which assessed, and they came out with the figure of 1,170 as something that the country could take. But our government has decided to be more friendly to the corporate groups, you know, and bring it down to 1,001. So, I mean, it's better than 1,050. We would have been happier if we'd gone back to the 1,170 or 1,200 because we think businesses, our assessment is they can take it. You know, they always cry crocodile tears and say they'll go under. You know, but if other things are there for them, they're not going to run, you know, and the market gets better. I mean, you know, you put more money in the hands of the bottom 20%, 30%, their marginal propensity to spend is very high. They spend any extra money they get. You know, they give an extra $100 to a person earning $20,000 a month. It's unlikely that his expenditure will increase by 100. Whereas in the poorer sectors, yes, it would, because they haven't met their basic needs. So really, it will spur aggregate demand, which businesses need, you know, to sell to. So it would be a good thing for us to do that, you know.
Is this a budget that is friendly to the B40 group?
Well, there are some things there which are good, you know. So not, it's not entirely a, so it's quite it's got some bad points in it, but it's got some good points in it. I mean, the fact that they didn't cut the health budget or the education ministry budget, you know, they maintained that. They cut things like primary commodities, you know. So they cut off certain of the big mega projects, the ECRL, the high-speed train, LRT3. So those, that is good. You know, what they cut were things that they should have cut. Whereas, you know, like health, I'm not still not happy with this a 2 billion increase, but at least, you know, there was a bit of an increase. It's not enough. I think we need about a 30% increase right now. There's so much of backlog in terms of damaged, faulty equipment that we need to replace. We need to build new hospitals in all our major state capitals. A lot of needs to be done, but so I think a 30% increase too wouldn't be fully enough, but it's only a few percentage increase. But at least it's not a decrease, you know. So I think that those things, I think, I would think it's good. They maintain BRIM under a different name. That I think is good.
All these measures that are targeted at the B40 group, the cash transfers you mentioned, there is the tax incentives for employers to hire senior citizens, and, you know,
it's a very good idea.
Does that mean we're going towards a higher retirement age?
Well, I think what they're doing, they're responding to a need that older people, people above 60, many of them still need to work because their savings are not enough, you know. But the downside of that is there's a lot of underemployment and unemployment among young people trying to enter the labor market, you know. So when older people can't leave the labor market because they have economic needs, then younger people also have problems as well. Yeah. So I think the main issues then is that there's not enough funds for old people when they retire.
And these are low-paying jobs too, because they're looking at the income level of 4,000 salary and below. So it's not exactly looking for experienced workers to fill in the skills gap.
That's right. That's why the PSM has been talking about the need for us to kind of phase in a pension, universal pension scheme. It can start low, it can start late, you know, in the sense that only for those above 70. Maybe those up to the age of 70, they can still do some work. But above 70, usually most of them have physical problems and it's difficult for them to work. And at that point, let's say we give them $300 a month as a stipend per person, you know, I think it'll do a great deal to help them, you know, for this. They still can't live on their own. They probably have to save with all their children. But the fact they get $300 a month means they won't burden their children economically, you know?
Yeah.
And we can have a more dignified life. Because now, many of the children also are strapped financially, staying in small terrace houses or in flats, and having, you know, high expenses for their own children, you know, the grandchildren, schooling, paying the house, paying back the PTPTN loan or whatever. So most of the younger generation also have problems, you know, supporting, not that they don't love their parents, but yeah, also in an economic bind, you see. This extra $300 a month, I think, would be a great relief. So I think something that if we can't do it right now, it'd be something that we should be thinking about. Because obviously what we are saving through our EPF is not enough. It doesn't last.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the sustainability of the pension system, I think, is something that the budget alluded to but did not go into much details. It's largely keeping to the status quo. But what you mentioned about this universal pension scheme, it sounds like a defined benefits kind of system, which a lot of countries around the world are moving away from because of the unpredictability of market returns, and they're moving more towards defined contributions model. Do you think this kind of universal system is sustainable?
I think the way in which the world is moving is not sustainable, where the top 0.01%, you know, are able to take a large, a large cut of the increase in wealth, transfer it to tax havens using all kinds of accounting measures, using price transfer tactics. A profit earned in Malaysia is not expressed in Malaysian dollars, not expressed in Malaysia. The good is sold at a depressed price to Caymans on paper, and in Caymans it's marked up four times and then sold to the US by a slight more markup. The main profits are in Caymans, which actually doesn't see the goods, doesn't produce the goods, only a paper transaction. But it's allowed in today's international financial system. You're allowed to do that. It's legal. You can transfer profits on paper to a place like Bahamas or Caymans or Virgin Islands where tax rates are low, maybe even zero because you got whatever pioneer status, so they don't pay tax either in the US where the goods finally go or in Malaysia. And that is why governments don't have money to finance redistributive programs like pension or healthcare or public transport. That is what we've got to address. We can't take this, the fact that the 0.1% are really taking us for a ride. We can't just take it as a given. Oh, it's God-given. This is how the economy is, the best economy possible. We've got to question, how come these guys are taking so much of the money away? Why can't they pay a part of the taxes? And it's not that Malaysia will be the only one saying this. There's a big group around Bernie Sanders in the US, for example, are saying the same thing. There's a big group in the EU. So we should be talking, how can we get all these voices together and we revamp the, we make tax havens more difficult to be misused. You know what I mean? We make sure that the rich, the richest 0.01% pay their share of the taxes.
Right.
Not they're going to go and just take away all their wealth, but so I think these are the things we've got to change the macroeconomic framework we are working within. Though right now we are constrained by it. Yes, we are constrained by it. We can't do something unilaterally because it'll shooting ourselves in the foot. But while doing so, our understanding of the system should be that we need to do something to attack this imbalance, to address this imbalance, And I don't see in the budget, I understand the constraints, yes.
Yeah.
But are we taking the constraints as natural, as God-given, as, something that we can't do anything about? Or are we saying that we are going to work on these constraints? It's going to take some time, obviously, But we must start working on it. But if we don't work on it, obviously they're going to remain every year.
One scheme that looks quite innovative is the affordable housing crowdfunding scheme. What are your thoughts on this model to get more people to own their own homes?
Well, I find it very intriguing. It's interesting. I won't reject it. But a lot of things went through my mind, is it? Because here it talks of Achong pays 50,000 and then Ali pays 200,000 on a peer-to-peer crowdfunding. And then the house belongs, then Achong stays in the house. But then how does Ali cash out when he wants, such after 10 years or 15 years, he wants to get the money? Does he sell the house? Who would want to buy the house with Achong staying there? Achong probably won't want to go. So I don't know the details of how is that going to work. Can Ali at some point evict Achong? What are Achong's rights? Or if Achong is careless with the house, the way he cooks and all that, and the whole house is in a bad shape, it's Ali's investment as well. If he doesn't look after his house properly, he allows the roof to leak, he doesn't repair it, the basics, the structure of the house gets weakened by the water seeping in and all that. That's also Ali's investment. So what are Ali's rights? Can Ali, what will Ali do? Because, he invested 20,000 in that house and this guy is not repairing the roof. How are you going to handle things like that? I think the operational details are very important. Unless you replace Ali with a government agency, and government agency subsidizes these houses so that Achong can only sell it back to the government agency. The government agency sells out as the first house. Every family will be given a first house and they can buy it. But the government actually owns, it's sold at a subsidized price to a family, and that family can only sell it back to the government. It can't use it for speculation, and it can't buy a second house like that. Maybe that, to replace Ali with a government agency, which then is properly managed, which has a housing bank, so people pay something towards the house, They also have an option of paying the full amount and taking it over completely, or they can stay, you know, as in a way like a tenant, but they own the house to some extent. I don't know. We can work on these things, you know. I thought it was a very interesting, innovative idea, you know, of how you get mobilized savings to do this. There are a lot of questions you have to kind of clarify. So I think the budget should be an opportunity for people to discuss it, and see what else could have been done, and be open, have ideas, and because that will help us make more plans in the future. Overall, I think it's not too bad a budget. Like I said earlier, it wasn't a recessionary budget, it wasn't an austerity budget. There are some good ideas.
Dr. Kumar, okay. Thank you for that.
Thank you for calling.
I've been speaking to Dr. Jayakumar Devaraj of Parti Socialist Malaysia about his thoughts on Budget 2019. You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
BFM's Budget 2019 programming was presented to you by Masing. Reinvent spaces. Enhance life.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.